Somebody had alerted Senator Zaroff that, yeah, he should be down here. I wish he was. I don't know where Fred's at.
Teresa, why don't you see if you can find Zaroff?
Yeah. Unless we want to do Alice first. But of course, we won't have a form to do it, so. Okay, well, who's our secretary? You ready? You're on record. Okay, we're going to take 205 first then. First of all, let me call Judiciary Committee to order Senator Szymanski and Senator Halford are present. Lacking quorum, we won't take any action at this time. The order of business today will be Senate Bill 205, Senate Bill 207, and last but not least, Senate Bill 108. My intent is to go to approximately 3:15, and that time we should be able to adjourn. Unless we lose a quorum before then, that time we will adjourn, anticipating another member here to make a quorum for action. What we'll do is take up Senate Bill 205, and for the record, the Senate Bill 205 says that current law provides that the Commissioner of Departmental Resources may issue a lease or set net fishing. The lease may be for a period not to exceed 10 years. DNR must establish a reasonable rental for the lease equal to the administrative cost involved in processing leasehold applications. Current law does not distinguish between resident and non-residents. Senate Bill 205 amends this law to provide that the rental fee for the non-residents of the state shall be 5 times the fee charged for residents. Thus, the state will be still charge residents a fee that is equal to the administrative cost of processing the application, but non-residents must pay 5 times that amount. Section 1 of the bill makes a certain legislative finding justify the treatment of the non-residents. Essentially, the finding claims that charging higher fee to non-resident tideland leaseholders is justified because there is an added enforcement burden associated with non-residents because there are conservation expenditures that non-residents do not pay for through the usual resident taxation method. Obviously, anytime you treat residents differently than non-residents, red flags are raised. And with that, I'd like to call Tom, is it Coaster?
Custer.
To the testify, make presentation on the that question, the red flag question, and then we'll proceed from there.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Currently, there is a...
Could you just restate your name
sure.
and who you're representing?
My name is Tom Custer. I'm from the Department of Law. There is a similar non-resident fee differential statute which relates to the fees charged for renewing, applying for and renewing limited entry permits. The courts will sustain the constitutionality of a differential fee between residents and non-residents if it can be demonstrated that there is a reasonable relationship between the fee charged non-residents and the added enforcement burden that they impose on the state because of their non-residency. We are defending the non-resident fee differential in the limited entry permit case on the ground that it does require additional enforcement, that residents pay for the administrative cost of the licensing program with the fee charged residents, that the additional fee charged non-residents relates to conservation of the resource and the extra costs which, as far as the resident goes, are borne by virtue of the normal costs that residents are required to pay through the use of state resources and so on. We believe it would be difficult to use the same justification for charging the non-residents in the limited entry context as is used to charge a non-resident fee differential in the tidelands leasing context. And so I guess our sense is that we would prefer to wait at least until the Supreme Court resolves the limited entry fee differential case before another statute is enacted imposing a fee differential on non-residents using the same justification. At minimum, if the bill was to go forward, we would hope that the legislature would in fact develop through the hearing process or have developed from the departments of Fish and Game primarily data regarding the costs, additional costs of enforcement with respect to non-residents, so that there would be some empirical data in the legislative record that we could use if and when a lawsuit is brought challenging the constitutionality of fee differential between residents and non-residents in the titled leasing context.
Thank you. I know the sponsors just joined us. Are there any questions, Mr. Booster?
Custer.
I keep having to change the spelling, but K-U-S. I'll put Custer in there. Mr. Custer, at this time, before we ask the sponsor to respond, I think that that's going to be that's the crux of the question before us. Any questions?
No, I would like to have Senators off, Tom and Craig stay at the table so we can just kind of discuss it, though, and try to figure out, because I think we're all sympathetic with what we're trying to do, and we need to figure out a way to do it.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, Senator Jarrah, for the record, District 10. I guess Senate Bill 205 is pretty self-explanatory, and I don't think that it doesn't set any real precedents, and that we do in other areas have fees that are charged differently for residents and non-residents, particularly in the area of the fishing industry. I believe that the non-resident fee is substantially more than what the resident would pay for your commercial fishing license. And I think that the concern that I have, and I'm more familiar with what we have in the Bristol Bay area, and an area that I have fished in the on the Anishinaabe River, is that there are a large number of non-residents that do fish the area, and they do come in, and they have been making substantial returns on the sites that they have, and basically leaving nothing in the state and returning. And that's not a real sound justification for putting this bill in. But I think there that what's also happened in this area, and people from DNR could express this as well, but the revenue that's generated from the shore leases helps to pay for the operation of that segment there in DNR, land and water. And what I'd like to do is increase those program receipts on the users that come in and utilize these services and then basically leave. What's been currently happening is that a shore lease was approximately $50, and in order for that department to continue providing the service for that particular part of their budget, they had started a program to increase the shore leases for everybody up to the tune of about $150 now. And that's basically residents and non-residents. And what I would like to see happen there is, at least in some areas, we start giving some consideration to our Alaskan residents and start getting some of the costs back from non-resident users. And it's basically a resource that, my feeling is, belongs to the people of the state. Now, I can't deny anybody the right to fish up there simply because they're not a non-resident, but I think certainly we can ask them to pay a little bit more so that we can continue to provide the service.
Thank you. Before, as Senator Pierce, Congressman Senator Pierce is here, the question that I think that what we're saying, Senator Zaroff, is even Mr. Custer, everybody wants to do what you want to do. So we all want to do it. The key question is whether or not we can give the AG's office, who will ultimately have to, or potentially have to, defend it, the foundation to defend it. Now they've drawn a correlation between the evidence that you put into your legislative finding section to your findings being the same basic findings that are being used in the Carlson versus State case, my understanding. And what they're saying is they don't believe that the findings here would carry through and support a court challenge at this time, if that's correct, Mr. Custer.
I think that is correct, Mr. Chairman. The difficulty is that in the Carlson case, we have developed data with respect to enforcement, and are using that data to justify the fee differential for the limited entry permit, for renewing and for fishing licenses. And it comes out just about right in that case. And so the problem is you can't add on additional justification. Now, one way that it could work is if the processing fee that DNR is charging is in fact about what their administrative costs work out to be for the program, there's nothing wrong with making non-residents pay their full share of those costs. And then letting the state pick up part of the tab for state residents. There's nothing constitutionally impermissible about that. But what we would like to see is some of that evidence, empirical evidence with respect to costs in the legislative record, because it makes our job much easier then to defend the constitutionality of the difference.
So what we essentially need is we need to get the DNR budget subcommittee component, or the budget component, down here in front of us. We need to know how much is spent in direct costs and indirect costs in administering this program. The number, total number of participants that spread over, the break between residents and non-residents, and then establish that our differential represents bringing non-residents up to the total cost of providing the service.
Correct. That would be
and
the
so
easiest
state that in the findings. And the substance of the bill is fine. We're dealing with findings and being able to prove what we're saying.
Absolutely.
Okay. That's what I think we got to do.
Okay. Now, it seems to me, though, I don't want to make this comment, that since it has a resources and judiciary referral, we can put that foundation from that perspective either in finance or, and probably more justifiably in finance, when it's before a finance committee, use that as a real strong foundation place. If from that perspective, unless there's technical language changes that we would have to make, but would you see any recommendation with regard to technical language changes that we'd have to make in order to modify the bill, or strictly foundation?
I would say it's foundational. I don't have any.
So then it seems to me that could be done as we move down the process.
And the question is, and it's to the sponsor, essentially, whether he would rather try and do that in this committee, do it in the resources committee, do it in the finance committee. And that's a matter as much as scheduling and just getting people, because it takes time to do it.
Yeah.
You know, we're gonna have to sit for an hour and go through the whole process and understand it and then draw some conclusions based on the understanding.
Well, Mr. Chairman, it's certainly up to you, whichever way you would prefer. I think we could handle this in the next committee of referral, or we can certainly handle it in finance.
Do you want us to move the bill?
I would prefer to have the bill moved, since it does go to resources and it does go to finance after that. If the committee feels uncomfortable in doing that, then we can certainly work at this level. But I think we could, since the technical part of the bill seems to be fairly consistent there.
Senator Pierce?
Well, I just have a question before we move it or don't move it. In our file is a letter dated April 21, 1983 to former Representative Wood, signed by Mr. Gisberg. And at that time, apparently Representative Wood was looking at completely shutting off the ability of non-residents to receive titlements, leases, and you were in this House at that time, I believe, Senator Darrell. Was there a bill introduced that died in the House that would have cut off, according to this legal opinion, that would indeed have been legal under the law of the land and certainly the laws of the state? Have you looked at that and decided that you'd rather let non-residents have leases and attempt to charge them more as opposed to just getting them out of the fishery, which I would certainly support?
I don't recall that particular bill, nor do I recall any of the discussions that may have taken place.
I can't tell from this whether it was a bill or just an opinion.
But I think we would probably run into some problems constitutionally if we tried to exclude non-residents from that type of activity.
I would
so
have to say that I'm not convinced that earlier opinion was correct.
That's too bad.
It's a commercial activity, not an optional activity.
Exactly.
So it's commerce.
The
question I have is we don't want this finding section, because this finding section is duplicative of what you're already doing. we pass the bill on, we just need to make sure, and there's enough of us on resources, I guess, we need to make sure that this bill does not go on with these findings, because then it endangers itself and the existing court case on other use of these findings. So if we don't amend it and just go ahead and move it on, our letter to the next committee or something to the next committee should say, or the recommendation, my recommendation is going to be then, do pass with changed findings, or something like this. So we've said we got to fix this thing, and we don't get it dumped out in the end and mess something up.
I would certainly concur.
Yeah. Then it'd be my intent then, if we take a motion from the committee to move the bill with a letter transmittal with it, transmitting at least to the next committee of referral, that a hearing specifically to address the finding section based on what the Department of Natural Resources operating costs are, and justifying the differential that the state of Alaska will assume for residents versus non-residents, and be established in committee hearings, so then an appropriate finding section can be taken care of.
Even better than that, I would ask that we have Mr. Custer give us a draft.
Maybe Mr. Custer can say. Do that.
And that will also help Betty when she gets it, because he can list, you got to establish 1, 2, 3, and 4.
Yeah.
And then she can call those people. The first hearing we have can be the right hearing. We won't have to go through it twice.
Sounds good to me.
Mr. Chairman, as we go through this, what I will do in the interim is contact the Department of Natural Resources and see that they have that information available for that first hearing and resources.
Good. Sounds good.
To speed the process.
Thank you. Senator Halpern.
I would move that we report out Senate Bill 205 with individual recommendations and ask unanimous consent.
No objection, so done. Next bill we're going to take is Senate Bill 207 relating to liens on real estate property, secure payment of services provided by a utility owned by a municipality. And bills by Senator Adams. I noticed that she's got his.
I just remembered. Did we request a fiscal note on this?
There is a fiscal note right there. Yeah, okay, we got a fiscal note there. But let me just say.
You're talking about different bills.
Do you have one previous one? We'll have one before we send it.
Okay, here's a zero fiscal note from, no, $120,000 revenue fiscal note from Department of Natural Resources.
Okay. Senate Bill 207, at the present time, Alaska law does not specifically grant the municipality owned by the utility power to place a lien on real property to secure payments owed to the utility. Senate Bill 207, CRNA, provides that the home rule, general law municipalities, home rule municipalities, first and second, third and class, boroughs, first and second class cities may, by ordinance, provide for the creation of a lien to secure payment of services provided by a municipal-owned utility, including the payment of interest, penalties, administration costs incurred by the delinquency. According to Tam Cook, municipal-owned utilities probably have this power. Anyway, this is because municipalities are statutorily authorized to exercise any power not prohibited by law. Since the creation of the lien or utility services not prohibited by law, the argument would be municipalities may do this. However, some are concerned that a court, if it were to consider this issue, might hold that municipalities cannot create liens for utility service. This is because the state law specifically authorizes municipalities to create liens for certain other activities such as property taxes, for sales and use of tax and use taxes, and for special assessments. The argument is that if the legislature grants certain lien power to municipalities, then it does not intend for them to be able to create liens in any area in which the power has not been specifically granted. And Martha, you want to present Senator Adams' case?
For the record, I'm Martha Stewart. I'm a Senator Adams who's unable to be here today. Seem to have covered most of the issues around this bill. Senator Adams introduced this legislation at the request of Senator Coghill via the city of Nenana that requested that the legislature grant specific authority. There is nothing in this bill that would require that municipalities do this. We are aware of at least one city that has an ordinance on the books presently. As you said, this would just give them a specific authority. The only change that was made in the CNRA committee was to remove a section that initially had given these liens priority over other liens, and that was removed at the request of the sponsor.
Any questions of the committee? My recommendation would be to move the bill. It seems to me that it's reasonable, maybe not 100% necessary, but it's a little better than nothing. My recommendation would be move it.
I move that we report
Senator,
out.
Okay. Senator Pierce.
In an area where the power authority owns the utility and payments are made to the power authority, could this still happen? I mean, could the power authority? I think the power authority builds. Does the building control the villages, or have all of those power or all the what am I trying to say? The generators and stuff actually owned by the villages, or some of them owned by APA. I'm just wondering if they need that authority also.
In the chair. It varies by, at least from the area that I'm most familiar with. In some villages, they own the generators, and some, like AVEC, does. I don't know whether APA has the authority to do this. I know that private utilities wouldn't have the authority. They could go through other means, such as, well, number one, they would probably shut off the utility, seek the services of a collection agency, and then go through a judicial process to get a judgment for payment. I'm not familiar with their APA or sub-agencies if I have this authority or not.
Well, I think we're leaving Chugach out. I assume they don't care. They haven't exactly been waiting for it to say, we want to be part of this. But on the other hand, that's a huge push in certainly my municipality in terms of the utility.
They have authority.
Power. How do they have authority?
They have authority to lien their private entity.
How do they have authority?
They go through the court.
They go through the court.
Final lien.
But they can't just come there.
Yeah, right.
But maybe they have the ability to go to court. This utility, what they're saying here is the municipal utility may not necessarily have that authority to go to court.
Yeah, I think they do, but they're worried that they don't.
Yeah. Any questions? Objection? Motion?
No. Move out Senate Bill 207 CRA. By the way, I would have had objection to the original version.
Yep, I think that was improved. Hearing no objection, so move. Oh, now we're up to our favorite bill. And we're moving right along. We're gonna have this one zipping right through. Oh, this is a good one. Senate Bill 108, an act relating to public finance, including lease financing and providing for an effective date. The primary purpose of 108 is to centralize all lease financing of public buildings in the Alaska State Building Authority. The governor claims...
Housing Authority. The bill is out of date and wrong already.
Right. Well, we'll fix that, no problem. The governor claims that four reasons for doing this is efficiency, accountability, market acceptance, and coordination. Bill is allegedly, well, I can't believe this may be biased written. The bill is allegedly motivated by the fact that the lease financing is paid by the general fund and its rate is based upon the state's credit rating. All lease financing is considered part of the state's debt burden. Having multiple agencies enter into lease financing arrangements can have an adverse effect on the state's rating and frustrate efforts to coordinate issuances. In your file, you will find that the governor's transmittal letter containing a sectional analysis of the original bill and a memo from the State Affairs Committee explaining the additions made in the CES. Note that the bill distinguishes between lease financing and lease purchasing. Definitions are given in Section 10. Briefly, lease purchasing involves leases that extend for the project life of the building or which transfer ownership to the lease at the end of the lease. lease issued by the leasor. Thus, all lease financing is included in the definition of lease purchasing, but not all lease purchasing is lease financing, whatever that means. And they tell me, briefly, that the bill centralizes all lease financing, including that done by the legislature. I'm curious how that happens, which requires the legislature and judicial branches to notify the legislature of lease purchasing agreements with the annual payment of more than $1 million. It takes an annual payment of $1 million to trigger a notification. You may be interested in how this bill affects the Anchorage Courthouse. Section 12 of the CS exempts projects authorized by law before July 1, 1984 from the requirement that a lease finance agreement only be entered into unless the building authority to act as grandfathered into the court. The act to grandfather in the courthouse, which was authorized by law before that date. Thus, the court system may still enter into a lease financing agreement itself and build a courthouse. With that, take on.
You stole my thunder, Mr. Chairman. I guess would just emphasize that the main effect of this bill would be to consolidate lease financing in the housing authority, building authority. And the real motivation behind that is that If you don't do that, what happens is the debt frequently on a lease financing would be issued by a developer or a municipality. And a lot of times they're going to have interest that may be somewhat at odds with the state with respect to the scope of the project. They may want to see a more elaborate project than the state might want to, for various reasons. They may not be as sensitive to the financing costs. You tend to see multiple financial advisors rather than just one. The operating cost of the facility down the road may be higher as a result of broadened scope or the debt service being higher if the financing costs aren't controlled as carefully. So it's really a cost effectiveness type measure for the state that is the reason it's being introduced. If you like, I can go over some of the provisions of the bill. In the last committee of referral, it was there were some amendments that tightened up the authorization of the University of Alaska debt issuance, not only lease financing, but any debt that they would issue. But other than that, it is pretty much a lease financing bill as you reviewed it there.
Senator Halford.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. This gets us into an area that has, for me, long been a difficult one because, as Mr. Barker said, this authorizes state debt. State debt can't be authorized unless it's approved by the voters. And what we've done is we've built a system of lease purchasing and lease financing that has effectively defined itself out of being state debt. And yet, when the combination of cancellation penalties, non-substitution agreements, and so forth, combined to make it impossible not to continue the lease, it's very clear that we're obligated to make the appropriation. I mean, if we take a constitutionally mandated function and sign an agreement that we will cease performing the function unless we perform it from the building we've just leased from this builder, that has got to tie together to be a debt of the state.
Well,
I wonder if you could just...
Well, Mr. Chairman, I guess I might respond. I certainly agree that from a credit standpoint, this is debt. And Moody's and Standard & Poor's will tell you the same thing. In fact, I just happened to have a Moody's release on lease financing. And I might just read here. They say... regardless of whether lease obligations are legally considered to be debt in any particular state, Moody's views all lease obligations issued for capital purposes as debt. More importantly, Moody's expects issuers of lease obligations to honor their lease commitments. From Moody's point of view, the credit quality of a municipal borrower's debt will depend on its ability and willingness to meet all of its obligations, including those involving leases. Therefore, even if lease obligations are not legally defined as debt for particular municipalities, Moody's will include leases in its calculations of such debt ratios as debt burden and debt per capita. So from a credit standpoint, it's definitely debt. Question whether it's legal or not is one for the lawyers, I guess. I would just point out that this bill, with respect to lease financing, does not authorize or expand the authority of agencies to issue debt on a lease basis. But what the bill says is if debt is issued as lease financing, it's going to be done through the building authority, so the state's on top of the situation.
Let me ask you, though, is there a way that we can address Senator Alpert's question and concern, which is, at what point in time can you, is there a fine line or is there a specific departure point between a lease that would not be considered long-term debt and a lease that is? And obviously, if I had a lease that had no penalties or anything else attached to it, and you could break it tomorrow and walk away, that's obviously not a lease that's long-term debt impacting. The other one that is where the penalties and everything else exceed, cost you more to get out than it does to stay in, says common sense keeps you in, it's long-term debt. Is there a way that we could address that?
Yes, sir. In fact, there are lines that can be drawn. Now, that's not to say that people can't and don't come up with situations that cross those lines or still result in gray areas. But, in fact, on page 4, I'm looking at the CS anyway, let's say section 10, I believe, in either bill, we have defined lease purchase agreement, which is your long-term type lease obligation. And I would contrast a lease purchase agreement with a true operating lease. In a lease purchase agreement, you are, in effect, purchasing the facility on time. And it gives four conditions here that any one of which would cause it to be considered lease purchase debt as opposed to a true operating lease. And those four conditions are from the Financial Accounting Standards Board definitions that they use to identify a capital lease. So it is possible to draw lines, but it's also possible to come up with situations that take account of things that aren't in the definition and will fuzz the lines a bit. But this can essentially draw a ring around most situations.
Well, but we define it, but then we go ahead and allow it.
No, again, this bill doesn't either increase anybody's authority or decrease anybody's authority to do lease financing. So if that concern, I guess, there's no reason that can't be addressed in the bill. If you want to put voter approval in as a requirement, that's something that could be put in the bill, but it could be changed with passage of any legislation for a specific project. So you really, I think, want a constitutional amendment if ultimately it would be desirable, if that's the sort of thought you have in mind.
I just say that from my perspective, I'm going to say one thing, necessarily voter approval. Can the legislature can incur debt by legislative approval, couldn't it?
Theoretically not. The Constitution.
Even though we do it?
We do it, and I mean, it started with the court system. That's why it's always been hard to appeal these things. I mean, that building right there is a lease purchase building. And so the Supreme Court can sit in their chamber created by a lease purchase debt and rule on the case. And my concern has always been that might not be a totally arm's length ruling. But I think at least we should look at some kind of definition in this statute. I have been working on a constitutional amendment provision that essentially tries to deal with the definition and says what is debt. But the other problem is you do need to be able to lease things. For example, if you have a specific requirement and nobody in the private sector will build it for you, will produce it for you, will have this product, unless they know that they've got more than a one-year commitment to buy it, then you're killing yourself if you can't do it. Where I think the abuse is,
is where you use a revenue bond. The revenue is a state appropriation. It's a huge long-term thing, as the Anchorage Court Building was set to be. Several other have been. And the combination of penalties exceeds the value of the lease. So, you're obviously incurring debt. And I've got a bill draft here. I had it in, and I want to try it just to see what Milt has got to say. But take a look at this for just an idea of language. Basically, what it does is it says if it draws the line at five times the average annual payment. So the penalty can't exceed five times the average annual payment for this lease, assuming that you're not going to be able to build at least great huge mega projects on revenue bonds and get them paid off in a five-year time span.
Mr. Chairman, I don't have a basic, I don't see any basic problems with this, but I think from a practical standpoint, all the leases I've looked at really allow the state to cancel for, at least for non-appropriation, without any penalty whatsoever. So I'm not sure this would ever really limit anybody much. You typically don't see penalties in at least the lease purchase obligations for cancellation of the lease. It's always subject to state appropriation.
But don't they? Isn't the non-substitution provision a penalty?
Well, it's yes. I mean, that's it's certainly a penalty, but I've never seen a monetary value attached to it.
See, what we do is we lease it, and I got the packet on one of these trying to figure it out a year or so ago. But we lease, the Seward Skill Center or whatever it is, and then we say that we're going to keep leasing this thing from whoever built it forever or for the full term of this thing unless we, number one, don't appropriate the money. But if we don't appropriate the money for that lease, we also, by contract, agree not to provide that service anywhere else. So we have to essentially abolish the service to avoid the lease.
Is that accurate? No.
That's frequently the provision in the lease.
Is there a penalty associated with it?
Well, there's no monetary penalty made.
The court could rule against this if we decide to move down the street and consolidate office space. If the legislature line item reduced a department lease space, and you said as a result of that the lack of appropriation was there, and you moved down the street breaking the lease and moved into somebody else's area, consolidation,
they would
go to court and say our lease says you can't move into like space. So it's
right.
So now how do we fix that?
Well, I think possibly that particular fix is to prohibit non-substitution clauses in the lease. That won't make lease financing impossible. It means the credit won't be quite as good, and we might pay slightly higher interest rates, but it would preserve that option for the state, and that may be a good policy decision.
Stop it in a reasonable way. You've known this. We've talked about this long ago. How do we deal with it?
Well, I guess I'm not clear on how we define the situations that you want to prevent.
Well, what we want to avoid is those situations where we're using the revenue bond mechanism to avoid voter approval on projects that would never be approved if the voters had a chance to approve them, and yet tie us down. I mean, and I can tell you that there are direct examples of that in the time that I've been here.
That's one point, but then the non-substitution clause.
Well, that's actually a part of the package. That's
kind of a part of it. I don't know whether or not we can
deal with
the
mechanism
whole,
that makes it work.
Well, eliminating the non-substitution clause won't jeopardize lease financing. It could still be done without non-substitution.
Well, if somebody outside of state government really wants to take the chance that the state is going to always lease this thing, I don't have a problem with that. I think that's fine. It's just when the state kind of, it uses contractual provisions to avoid constitutional provisions and puts the impairment of contracts provision against the debt provision to get away with doing what it wanted to do.
Well, let's do this. We're going to, what I'd like to do is have you and Senator Halpert work this out and, as soon as possible, bring the bill back before the committee. But it seems to me that half a loaf and then a full loaf of bread, if we can get a full loaf of bread out of this, we have to do it. But the minimum we have to do is come up with language which you've drafted here, if this is acceptable type of language. But this doesn't take care of and address the problem of non-substitution. But you guys can work out a creative way to work on that and maybe leave a little softness or flexibility in the department that send a strong enough message where we don't mind it completely out of it.
Well, I'd be glad to try and give us some thoughts, see if we can't come up with something.
Maybe there's a happy medium there.
Well, see, I would have, my initial position was to stop everything multi-year. Mm-hmm. You can't do that because you lose the ability to get things at a reasonable cost. What happens is a potential provider then has to either build, it's not just a facility. It's the state needs to lease an airplane with specific equipment. If it's a one-year lease, no manufacturer is going to fill all this radio gear that the fire service needs or somebody else unless they charge an arm or leg for it. If they've got a three-year lease, it's going to be a lot cheaper.
Right.
That's the problem. But that's not where the abuse is, but that's what, if the net is too fine, that's all the things, it catches all those things.
Committee adjourned.